Hi, welcome to this week's program. Welcome back to Steve Goes to Broadway. This is part three of my investing adventure along the Great White Way, so-called because it was one of the first streets in the U.S. to be lit with electric lights. In part one of my adventure, I wrote about my interview with Ken Davenport, a successful and well-regarded Broadway veteran producer, and I then decided to try my hand at a small investment in his latest production called Getting the Band Back Together. A few weeks later, I was entirely surprised and delighted to hear that Ken Davenport, the producer, won a Tony Award for his current Broadway show, Once on This Island. Things were now getting interesting. Would his next show about this band getting back together be as successful? Would I, a novice first-timer, be part of a great Broadway hit? Visions of Hamilton danced in my head. I better slow down and get a hold of myself. Back to the Tony Award. Well, it just so happened that I knew a talented actress who had won a Tony some years ago, and I called her and asked her if she'd come on the air to tell what it was like and how, and to what degree, it had changed her career. So part two of Steve Goes to Broadway was created. All right, fast forwarding to the present. Opening night, August 13th at the Belasco Theater in the heart of Broadway. We arrived a few days early to visit friends and family, and I snapped a pic as I Ubered to the producer's office to pick up my tickets. Now, the producer's office is right in the heart of Times Square, which of course makes all the sense in the world, but it reminded me of the small-town nature of the Broadway community, so much concentration in just a few streets and just a few avenues. Opening night was a hoot. The theater was filled with many well-wishers, investors like myself, other producers of the show, Broadway veterans and critics, more on the critics later. Ken, the producer, spoke at the beginning stressing how the script, the music, and the entire production was entirely original, which is apparently a rare thing on Broadway these days. Lights down, and the play began with a fun song. Setting up the main character and the precarious situation in which he found himself, having just lost his job on Wall Street and fretting over whether he should move home to live with his mother in New Jersey. Now, from that moment on, the play kept a steady pace of jokes, music, and comic situations, which delighted the audience at every turn. Standing ovations were the result of all this frolicking, and we all headed to Dave & Buster's a few streets over for after-party food and drinks. Actually, Dave & Buster's was a good choice, considering that the play's main characters are just regular folks living, as they say in the show, in western, eastern, central Middlesex County, New Jersey. They had a live band there, which makes total sense considering the play's title, Getting the Band Back Together, and food and drinks were plentiful and free while hundreds of people milled around hoping for a glimpse of the cast members and stars of the show, which included Mary Lou Henner, the actress from the TV show Taxi, if you remember, and many other movies. Unfortunately, Mary Lou and the other stars were cordoned off in a separate room for pictures and interviews, so I never got a chance to say hi. We hung out for a while and headed back to the hotel. Next morning at breakfast, we quickly picked up the New York Times and searched for the review. Unfortunately, the review was less than favorable. Actually, it was scathing. It pointed out many of the aspects of the show which I didn't even notice as a novice. The lighting, the costumes, the stage design, for example. Well, I thought, you know, this is the reason I got involved, to follow the ups and downs from insider's vantage point and to see how the process, good or bad, unfurled. Luckily, there were good reviews, too, from Variety and other media outlets, but the New York Times review had a particular sting. Well, guess what? Minutes later, as if on cue, I received an email from Ken, the producer, addressing the review. Wow, I wondered, what could he possibly say about this review to all his wishful investors and actors? He got to the point immediately. He wrote, "I'll be honest, the critical response was not what we had hoped, but that said, it is also not unexpected. Our show never intended to be the Iceman Cometh. It was built to do what musicals were originally designed to do, to entertain. and to allow our audiences to escape from everything else going on in their lives and in the world. The show's audience demographics are not the same as the critics, he went on to say, and incredibly successful shows like Thoroughly Modern Millie, Jersey Boys, and even Les Mis opened to reviews that weren't what the producers had dreamed about. Plus, he continued, there are tons of shows with great reviews that were never commercially successful. And finally, he went on to say, while initially the road will be bumpier than he had hoped, they are counting on word of mouth to get them through the slow summer season. The next day, August 15th, we received another email with a promotional picture and a request to send it to all of our friends and post it in social media. But there was more to come. The updates have been coming. Here's a highlight from an August 20th email. Quote, last week, opening week, was obviously a challenging one. A couple of performers got bronchitis and were out for a couple of shows, but now they're back. Special two-for-one tickets did raise the audience count, and a heavy TV commercial schedule, as well as a large direct mail drop, will attempt to break through those no-fun critical reviews. Well, upbeat as always, Ken is telling us that the audience continues to have a blast, and he received several emails from major industry heavyweights, including several Tony winners, telling him how much they love the show. And social media response has been terrific, he said. But now more than ever, they were working hard to get through the typically slow summer, and all hands were on deck to promote and spread the word. In addition to doubling down from traditional advertising, he said they also have put a bunch of grassroots initiatives in the works, like shooting a video of audience reaction to see if it could be turned into a commercial, inviting 100 rock stars and 500 general celebrities to see the show in the hopes of getting some social media love, exploring paid New Jersey celebrity social media influencers to support them, and finally handing out business cards at performances, encouraging people to leave Facebook reviews. Then a few days later, some bad news. Losses have been more significant than projected, and waivers and deferrals have gone into effect to conserve cash. Some good news, they're recording the cast album, which they hope will build them a merchandise income stream. So we'll have to see. So now we hold our breath, hoping to pick up some steam from the sum of all their efforts. So until next time, remember to visit stevepomerantz.com and see my posted pics from my New York trip and stay up with our Steve Goes to Broadway series and much, much more. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Hey folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick. I'm putting on a live event and I'm titling it Protecting Your Family and Your Wealth Through These Uncertain Times. Whether you're getting ready to retire or already in retirement, I've got some info to help you live your best retirement life. So here are some of the topics I'll be covering. The five gremlins that could ruin your best laid plans. And how do you keep your sanity in this news crazy world? Also, what are the best healthcare options for you and your aging parents? Or how do you navigate the loss of a partner and a divorce? And as always, my approach to retiring successfully. And plus, once again, I'll give my fearless forecast for the rest of the year, like the prospect of rising interest rates and what it means to us? And how about those tariffs? How will they affect our lives? And you know, many pundits are talking about an impending recession and an accompanying market downturn. Is that really in the cards for 2018? You'll also have a chance to ask me any question that's on your mind, because as always, my mission is to educate and empower you to help you make the right choices in your life. So join me Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. Once again, that's Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. For reservations, sign up at our website. You know it. It's stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. We've all heard the horror stories of people that have been victim to identity theft, but now there's a new angle, child identity theft, and it's particularly insidious for the reasons I'll discuss with my next guest, Michael Bremer. Michael is Vice President of Experian Data Breach Resolution Group and Consumer Protection. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
First, very quickly, define identity theft for us.
Identity theft comes in all shapes and sizes. In its simplest form, it could be someone stealing your credit card for financial gain. On the other end, it could be the loss of your medical insurance information, medical records, driver's license, social security number, or all of the above.
And obviously the results of every level, you know, can be quite disturbing. I mean, if someone takes your credit card, you're kind of protected. But if someone has your social security number and other vital data like that, it could actually hurt you. But there's a new angle, as I said, because now you just conducted a survey focusing on identity theft for children. Tell us about that.
Well, at Experian, we're always looking to listen and innovate on new trends, and especially when it comes to identity theft. We spotted the worrying trend that there are more and more children that are victims every year. And I'll put that into perspective. Last year alone, there were about 17.6 million adults that were victims of identity theft. And one in seven children, or 1 million victims last year, were people under the age of 18. And it's particularly important to note the fact that most of these victims, according to the survey that we did, and we surveyed 500 actual victims, said that the theft started around age 12, and less than half of them did not discover it until they were 16 or 18 years old.
I think that's why it's insidious, because your child's not using that information when they're age 12 or 13 and 14. They only discover it many years later, so their name could have been used for criminal purposes for 10 years.
Exactly. And there's no reason for a child under the age of 16 to have their social security number given to them, a social security card, or even to give it to somebody else. And that's why parents, as one of the preventions, need to take that precaution as a first step.
So what are some of the signs that identity theft may have taken place?
Well, the most obvious sign is that you're going to get something in the mail or a phone call from a creditor, from a store, from a financial institution that says they want to take action in that child's name. It could be as simple as a free line of credit. It could be for a government ID. It could be for a national change of address form, something like that. That's unusual that someone under the age of 18 wouldn't be getting otherwise. That's usually a first sign. And unfortunately, if you're waiting until that happens and you don't detect it on your own, then the identity could already be compromised in many places.
Would a pre-approved credit card be one of those items?
That's a real common one that we see. The other thing that we'll see is applications for store accounts, you know, a Best Buy card, a Target card, those types of things. So any of those are usually an early warning sign.
I would think that child identity theft would be more lucrative in many ways than adult because of this long time frame that they get to use that information. Is that a fact?
That is very true. Our survey pointed out, Steve, that 1 in 4 of the respondents are still dealing with child identity theft even 10 years after they discover it. And with 82% of the respondents saying that the Social Security number was the primary thing that they took, there are also other things that go along with that. And it could be the new driver's license. It could be a medical insurance card for their parents and those things. And unless you actually start to see it early on, it can go undetected until you are traditionally applying for that first loan or a credit card when you might be 16 or 18.
Now, last week, you, I think, Experian held their first Child Identity Theft Awareness Day and have set up a way to scan for this. Tell us about that.
Yes, we were very excited on September 1st that we sponsored the first National Child Identity Theft Awareness Day, not only to draw attention to the issue, but also to remind parents they have to be the ones, whether they be a parent or a guardian, that are protecting the child's identity. And along with the sponsoring of the Awareness Day, we also announced our free child scan. And what it is, it allows a parent or guardian to put in the child's Social Security number and then see if there is an existing Experian credit file that's been created. The scan is at www.experian.com/child scan, and it's very simple. It takes less than 5 minutes for the parent or a guardian to do it and immediately see if there's a credit file already existing, which in itself is a problem.
I see. Well, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was a phishing possibility here. If a person received an email offering this, are you guys sending out any emails, or you just trying to market it through the media and then have people come to the site?
Well, we're just like the IRS. We don't go ahead and market anything over the phone or send out any links. And if you're getting that, it is really a security problem. So we have national media on it, and we're allowing people to come to our website and go ahead and sign up on their own. But there is no outbound campaign because...
Okay, good.
In fact, that would be a good thing for a phishing scam.
Exactly. So go to Experian.com/child scan and you can get that done. My guest is Michael Bremer. He's vice president of the Experian Data Breach Resolution Group and Consumer Protection. Let's talk about some steps you can take to avoid getting into trouble here. Tell us what a parent and a child should be thinking of doing, and also how we should be educating our children.
Well, there are three big things, Steve. First, never give your child, especially under the age of 16, there's no need for them to know their Social Security number, let alone have a card. Second, if they do entrust the child to use that Social Security number, they need to know where it's being used, because you don't need to give it away for a doctor's visit. The schools don't need to have it, and it sure doesn't need to be posted on social media. So keep that away from the child. Second thing is, make sure that that child isn't out there using any personal identity information, let alone Social Security, on social media. I use the example of the kid who just got his driver's license, who gleefully posted it on his Instagram account.
Yeah.
Of course, he's just compromised his own driver's license number.
Mm-hmm.
And then last but not least, and you touched on this a little earlier, if there's any request for any information that your child receives or the parent receives to provide a Social Security number or provide any personal information, in most cases, people are not going to be outbounding to you to try to get that information. So just don't give it up.
Yeah.
And so those tips are great to be able to tell the child, just like, hey, don't take candy from strangers. Don't open any email links. Don't click on anything. If you get a strange phone call on your phone from somebody that's asking for information, just hang up.
My guest, Michael Bremer with Experian, their Data Breach Resolution Group and Consumer Protection Division. And if you have a question about what we just discussed, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us anything that you'd like. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, and we'll send you the weekly commentaries and interviews straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Hey, have you signed up for my live event yet? For those of you who may have just tuned in, it's Thursday, September 13th at 10 a.m. at the Renaissance Hotel in Boca Raton. That's Thursday, September 13th at 10 a.m. For more details and to sign up now, go to stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I'm very happy to welcome back Christine Benz, who is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance and also the author of a couple of books, 30-Minute Money Solutions, A Step-by-Step Guide to Managing Your Finances, and The Morningstar Guide to Mutual Funds, 5-Star Strategies for Success. Now, Christine writes on many personal finance topics, so today I picked one that I'm seeing more and more in my own financial planning practice. One of Christine's latest articles counts 75 must-know statistics about long-term care. Now, we're surely not going to go through all of them, but I highlighted those that I thought would be ripe for discussion. Hey, Christine, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Let's just take a look at the broad picture in terms of how much is being spent, let's say, from the year 2000 to today.
Yeah, so the cost in 2000, $30 billion was spent to cover long-term care related expenditures. By 2015, that number had jumped up to $225 billion,
yeah.
So roughly 8 times the amount of expenditures in that 15-year period. So we're seeing big increases. We have an aging population, and that's one of the big reasons why.
Well and above just a typical adjustment for inflation, well above that.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. This is syncing up with the fact that we are aging as a population, and with that come increased outlays for long-term care.
So if $225 billion is being spent now, this is a good time for companies to be getting into this business. And I know that in my area, we're seeing a lot of assisted living facilities popping up kind of all over the place, like mushrooms, really. So everybody's getting in on the act. And I think there's probably still some room for that to grow.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of different variations in care delivery. In fact, we were helping my mother-in-law look at assisted living facilities and just finding that the types of facilities varied so dramatically, as well as the ways that you might pay for them. So, you know, there might be some that require kind of a buy-in type situation and others that require monthly outlay. So they're all different and it can be complicated to choose among them.
That's for sure. Also, when the money runs out, some facilities will accept Medicaid and some will not. So you have to be very careful about what you do there as well.
That's right.
The percentage of people turning age 65 who will need some type of long-term care services in their lifetimes is 52%. So about half of us who are turning age 65 will need some type of long-term care. When they say some type of long-term care, what do you think that means?
Well, this is typically care that is not medical care. So for most of us, our medical care, our health care will be covered by Medicare. These would be other services for sort of day-to-day maintenance, whether cooking in the home or getting dressed or bathing. All of the things that don't fall under the medical care heading would fall under this long-term care heading.
And there's always this question about how long long-term care will be needed. Will it be needed for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, or longer? What are some of the percentages that we're seeing there?
Well, generally speaking, we see people who are lower income individuals having a greater need for care over a longer duration. So about a third of people who are over 65 who are in the lowest 20% of income will have a long-term care need of 2 years or longer. About 20% of people who are in the highest income, 20%, will have a long-term care need of that duration. So we do see some discrepancy based on income. And we also see a discrepancy in terms of who will need care for a long period of time. So about 14% of the population will need long-term care for longer than 5 years. And that's the thing that gets us all worried, right? We think about, well, if we have maybe a long-term care outlay of 6 months or something like that, that's something we could probably cover with our portfolios. But if we have that long duration need for long-term care, that's what can really spell trouble for a portfolio's longevity.
Like a 1 in 7 chance that that will happen, which is relatively low, but actually 1 in 7, if you took that bet, I think you would expect to win a bet like that from time to time. So it's not as low as it may indicate. That's kind of a lot.
Yeah.
What about the average number of years, let's say, that women will need long-term care?
Well, this is interesting. So it's 2.5 years on average. So the women who do need long-term care, it'll be roughly 2.5 years on average. For men, it's actually lower. So 1.5 years is the average duration of long-term care for men. And the basic idea there is that because women tend to live longer than their spouses, usually they're the caregivers for their spouses. So they're providing some of that care on sort of an unpaid ad hoc basis, just as caregivers for their spouses, whereas their spouses predecease them. So women are typically left to pay for long-term care in some sort of other setting rather than in the home.
You know, I think us men have to step up to the plate here. We really do, you know, because I don't know if we generally have the caregiver gene, but we've got to do something to do this better. Let's talk about Alzheimer's, because that's another big issue in an aging America. 10% of Americans over age 65 have Alzheimer dementia. So 1 in 10, that seems like a pretty high number to me.
It is. And we see that number really jump up for the older segments of our population. So of people over age 85, that number jumps up to roughly a third of the population is experiencing some type of cognitive decline. Mm-hmm. The kind of perverse thing about all of this is that the healthier you are, the longer you're likely to live. And that in turn, that long life expectancy or that long lifespan makes you more susceptible to encountering dementia later in life.
Yeah, so that doesn't mean don't live a healthy life. It means that it's like a catch-22, you know?
It is, absolutely.
Dying younger solves a lot of problems, but nobody wants to die young. So that's kind of ridiculous, yeah.
Exactly.
What about the percentage of individuals that are turning 65 now spending less than $25,000 or greater than $250,000? What is the percentage of those that are spending less than $25,000 on long-term care?
Yeah, it's about 58%. And this statistic was between 2015 and 2019. So that's, to some extent, kind of an encouraging number. So the idea is that of individuals turning 65, their outlays for long-term care over their lifetimes, to the extent that they have them, will be pretty minimal. So $25,000, you'd rather not pay those expenses, but it's probably manageable in many middle-class households. On the other hand, if you happen to be part of that cohort where there's a long-duration long-term care need, of course, that's more costly. So about 15% of the population does incur a sustained long-term care need that's very, very costly and that exceeds $250,000.
So a quarter of us, literally 27% according to these numbers, will have long-term care expenses between $25,000 and $250,000.
Right. And that syncs up with the idea of, you know, maybe the typical long-term care duration is like 2 years.
Yeah.
And so the outlays would fall somewhere between those two poles, not $25,000, not higher than $250,000, but somewhere between.
When we put these numbers in our financial planning software, we usually use 4 years and adjust it pretty heavily for inflation. So we're going beyond the average, but, you know, we don't take it out longer or take it too short as well.
You'd rather be safe than sorry on this front. So you'd rather be conservative. And I think you're really wise to mind the inflation of these costs because the most recent inflation rate for nursing home costs was 5% between 2016 and 2017. Yeah. Staggeringly high inflation rate, much higher than the general inflation rate.
Yeah, but the good news is that for 5 years, it was 3.8%.
So it was a little bit lower, but that short-term number did give me pause, in part because we've got a caregiver shortage. And that's one of the reasons why I believe these numbers are inflating so rapidly.
The annual cost for an assisted living facility in 2017 is $45,000. And I'm having this experience as well, as we're helping a family member. And we're finding that it's about $40,000 to $45,000 for assisted living. Now, there are different kinds of assisted living facilities. One's been described as kind of a Ritz type, which is much more expensive, many more services, than a Marriott type. So I'm talking really kind of about the Marriott type. In my area, South Florida, it's costing us about $40,000 to $45,000. What about a semi-private room and then a private room, Christine?
Yeah, so for nursing home costs, those are significantly higher than one would pay for assisted living. So with assisted living, you typically receive some or most of your meals in a group setting that are provided through the facility. With a nursing home cost, you're getting a lot more care because a person who is in such a facility needs more care. So $86,000 was the median annual nursing home cost for a semi-private room in 2017. For a private room, it's even more expensive, so it was about $98,000 in terms of the median. One point I would make there is just that we see a huge gradation based on geography. So people who live in large urban centers, like in Manhattan, for example, the average nursing home cost would be roughly $200,000 or even higher. Whereas in more rural areas, you may be lower than these median costs that I've just cited.
Good coverage on this very important topic. Christine Benz, Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance, has joined me. If you have any questions, don't forget to come to our website. If you want to read this again and get some of the links that are associated with this topic, we will have them there. And just a reminder that I'm putting on a live event Thursday, September 13th in Boca Raton at 10 a.m. So go to our website for more info, which is stevepomerantz.com. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thank you, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry's a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
When is 30 years going to come?
You know what? September. Well, I don't know the exact day, and I know we're in September, so next time we'll say 30.
We'll say 30. I think it's time for that. All right, let's get to it. So you know how long you've been complaining about no inventory?
Yes, I'm still complaining.
I know you're still. And yet, we saw an article together which listed these big institutions that are coming in and buying up swaths of single-family homes, residential homes, and then turning them into rentals. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we were living through those years, we saw this happening, and then all of a sudden, the inventory went away. It's like, well, where did all these tens of thousands of homes go? Well, they were being absorbed by these large private equity firms. Now what's happening is happening again. So it's probably contributing to part of the reasons why we have low levels of inventory.
I think so.
And these companies are coming in and doing it again because they can.
Well, I remember when way back when in 08, 09, and when things were really rough, Blackstone came in, and this was this was sanctioned by the Fed. They liked this idea. They came in and bought homes, and then they just rented them out to those people, many who lived there initially. So it's slowed down the eviction rate. It helped to bring capital into a depressed market.
That's right.
And that was good. Now, fast forward so many years later till today, now you have private equity firms coming in and buying huge amounts of real estate as well. And you and I asked the question before, like, what real estate are they buying? Because there's so little inventory.
Yeah,
to begin
with. You know, that's what I can't figure out. That, you know, to give you an example, Amherst Holdings raised $1 billion to buy single family homes and rent them out. Mm-hmm. And their program is going to be terms over 10 years. And the reason for the longer term is because they're anticipating that the market's going to decline a little bit. So they want to make sure that they capitalize on an up market. I personally don't know where they're getting the inventory from, because we don't see it out at, you know, as realtors, we don't see it on the streets. We're begging for new inventory.
And you could say, well, it's all over the country, but the bottom line is this tight inventory is pretty much, you know, everywhere.
That's right.
Yeah. So we don't know. But obviously, they're spending the money they're investing. Maybe they know.
And paying high
prices.
High prices, because we're at, you know, towards the top of a market.
Well, you know, sometimes there's just dumb money out there. You know, it may be institutional money, but they have their own drivers. For example, if you're an institution and you're raising $1 billion, you better fill that order.
Right.
So you may pay prices that are well above the market, and that creates this kind of dumb money that comes in. Generally a sign of the top of the market, or it doesn't mean things are going to crash, but it means that, you know, probably people are paying too much and then the cycle's going to turn. Those weak holders will burn out and then the strong holders will come in and the cycle goes on and on and,
and on. And on.
But we have a list of four or five here that are raising $500 million and $1 billion. The Texas Retirement Teachers Retirement Fund is involved in one of these. Singapore's Sovereign Wealth Fund is involved, so we'll keep an eye on it. We'll have to see.
It'll be interesting to follow.
All right, let's take a look at pending home sales. So July pending home sales were down 0.7% nationwide.
Yeah, that's nothing to be shocked about. The sales are down because, once again, I hate to say it, no inventory. And a lot of it is in the West and South. Those are the two regions of the country that are, you know, experiencing the greatest.
You're kind of your hottest regions, really, the South and the West.
Correct. Yeah. They're declining and, you know, it's just pulling the general numbers down.
Yeah. But when there's less inventory and there's demand, prices
go up.
Right. They rise. So that's what we're seeing as well. How much have prices risen?
Well, they actually jumped 6.3% year over year.
That's a lot.
Which is a lot. It really is. So, again, it's, you know, supply and demand.
And it's location.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because for years I lived in a house that went through this cycle and my house never even went up in price.
Yeah. You know, my family has homes in northern Maine and the values have been flat for 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely location. But here the thing as well that is affecting this is that we're starting to see incredibly high numbers of consumer confidence.
Absolutely. And that's what's driving the market. Anytime you have consumers that are very confident in their employment, their income, they're out buying. They buy consumer goods. They certainly buy homes, furniture, you name it, they buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little frustrating to see the consumer confidence so high, yet our sales so low. Mm-hmm. But you have to realize it's due to lack of inventory. And it's due to also pent up supply of sellers. I can't tell you how many sellers are out there that would love to sell their home, but when they take a look and see what's out there, they don't make the move.
Yeah.
And so we're in this vicious,
why do it? Taxes go up.
And I read another article that said the reason why this has all happened is because we don't have new construction of homes. So over the last decade, no new construction has really, I mean, it's there, but not like the boom.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who was thinking of moving who wants a new this, a new that, they can't, it doesn't exist. So they stay where they are. And
that's right. Right.
We do their homes.
Which reminds me, I was speaking with a client the other day, and now this is kind of, I guess, local humor, but up where I live, G&L Homes are one of those builds these Valencias.
Yes.
Right. So there was Valencia 1 and 2.
Cove Lake.
I don't know.
Pond.
And, right. Valencia Cove, Valencia Lake. And now there's a new Valencia.
Valencia Sea, Ocean.
It's like, will they ever run out of these Valencias, you know? Well, I guess it's better than naming it after some kind of Italian city, you know, Venice or something like that.
Yeah, we got those too. Tuscany.
All right. And finally, this was pretty interesting, but mortgage rates, which have risen over the last year, are kind of broken down into two parts. One, a conventional mortgage, conventional loan,
right,
and the other, a jumbo loan. Jumbo loans are loans greater than $453,000. And the rates on those jumbos used to be higher, but now they're lower.
I know. It's crazy. It's hard for me to explain why, but basically they are, except the fact that they are. To give you an example, about 15% of the home buyers are now taking out jumbo loans. Mm-hmm. So where back in 2009, it was only 6%.
Yeah. So, well, housing prices have gone up too, which also means that, you know, banks are willing to lend more and et cetera,
right. And it's more stringent to get a jumbo loan.
Yeah, it's harder. Yeah.
You know, your credit has to be much better.
Yeah. Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Hey folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick. I'm putting on a live event and I'm titling it Protecting Your Family and Your Wealth Through These Uncertain Times. Whether you're getting ready to retire or already in retirement, I've got some info to help you live your best retirement life. So here are some of the topics I'll be covering. The five gremlins that could ruin your best laid plans. And how do you keep your sanity in this news crazy world? Also, what are the best healthcare options for you and your aging parents, or how do you navigate the loss of a partner and a divorce? And as always, my approach to retiring successfully. And plus, once again, I'll give my fearless forecast for the rest of the year, like the prospect of rising interest rates and what it means to us. And how about those tariffs? How will they affect our lives? And you know, many pundits are talking about an impending recession and an accompanying market downturn. Is that really in the cards for 2018? You'll also have a chance to ask me any question that's on your mind, because as always, my mission is to educate and empower you to help you make the right choices in your life. So join me Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. Once again, that's Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. For reservations, sign up at our website. You know it. It's stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. If you're addicted to Shark Tank like so many people are, you know my next guest. In my view, he's the coolest guy in that room. His name is Damon John. Damon is the guy who literally started with nothing. He was raised in Hollis, Queens, New York, and slowly, sometimes painfully, built a huge business and an even bigger reputation built on integrity and giving back to the community. Let's find out about him and Shark Tank and what he's got going on right now. Hey, Damon, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate you having me.
Tell us how you began your first business, FUBU, For Us, By Us.
Well, you know, at a certain time where, you know, as we look at technology today, there was a disruptive way of communication coming out. It was basically called hip hop, and it was a different form of music where kids were talking about their sorrows, their joys, and their aspirations throughout this music and communicating with each other. And, you know, it started to create a certain ecosystem, which were brands that the kids were gravitating towards, but the brands weren't really marketing to the kids. And they actually started to deny that the kids were even supporting or wearing the brands.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was pretty frustrated by that. And I always wanted to create something or a brand that really respected and valued its consumers. So we came up with a name called FUBU, For Us, By Us. People actually thought it was purely for African Americans when that wasn't the case, because we didn't want to, you know, be prejudiced like we felt the other brands were against us. So it was an inclusive brand. It actually started to pick up in Japan and Seattle, Washington at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then it really started to spread amongst everybody who loved this new emerging form of communication and entertainment, which was called hip-hop. And FUBU, For Us, By Us was born.
So with all your experience throughout the years, you became an expert on branding and manufacturing and selling. But you know, there are a lot of people out there who know how to do that very well. What made you different?
You know what? I'm not going to say that I was any different. And, you know, when you talk about branding and manufacturing and things of that nature, I think that there are many people that are way better than I am. It's just that I knew my niche, I knew my consumer, and I'm the type of person that nobody's going to get up before me, nobody's going to go to sleep after me. I'm going to learn from my mistakes, and I'm going to, you know, repeat whatever I've done in a better way after I learn from my mistakes. It's all about just, you know, being really, you know, willing to get 99 out of 100 doors slammed in your face and keep returning.
Yeah, that's a good lesson. You know, in a recent episode, you chose not to invest in a new company that made these cool sunglasses out of wood, and you told them that earlier in your career, you had invested in a company that had cool products too, and then you said that all the cool brands are broke, and that this mistake cost you $6 million. What did you learn from that mistake?
Well, I learned that to understand the business, and my partners in Heatherette are really amazing designers, but they were not designers who could make ready-to-wear product, which is really where bulk of the business is done. And because I am an expert in men's apparel, I also could not help them make ladies ready to wear. So I'm not pointing the finger at them and saying that they weren't great partners and they weren't talented individuals. But, you know, I didn't really take inventory of the situation because I didn't realize that they didn't have the skill set and I didn't have the skill set in where the business needed to go.
And throwing money at them didn't really help either, did it?
Throwing money at them did not help. You know, most of the concepts out there, money does not help or does not make it. Money is a tool that's used after you prove the concept. And that's actually something I'm putting in my next book called The Power of Broke. It's utilizing knowledge and utilizing drive and studying the market to get your product out there in an original way.
Yeah, I think you frequently make that point on the show. So let's talk about the show for a minute. Which panelist on Shark Tank do you most like to go into a deal with, and who do you try to avoid?
I like going into deals with anybody that can add value to it, a great strategic partner. I tend to avoid dealing with Mark. You know, the guy's liquid, a couple of billion dollars, and,
yeah,
you know, I'm pretty frugal with my money, and Mark will pay a guy $1 million just not to call him every single day, and that's it.
I know you're speaking of Mark Cuban, and I noticed that he's not afraid to pay high prices for the businesses he bids on.
It's a rounding error for Mark, you know. It's real money for me as far as I'm concerned. You know, I give you $20, I want your dental records, so
yeah,
that's just what it is.
Is Mr. Wonderful really that obnoxious, or is that just his TV persona?
Well, it's not a TV thing. You have to think about what every investor is on that show for and where their specialty is. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a really a great guy, but, you know, a guy who has $1 billion under management, you know, if you have some money that you want to invest in one of his funds, do you want to see a guy up there who every time somebody sheds a tear, he's giving away money? So
he's a shark.
Yeah, I think he's a disciplined investor, you know, and sometimes you need that honesty. You know, you look at somebody who sits there and they have an idea in a company and they're spending their kids' college fund and they're not really doing their due diligence on a company. And sometimes you need a Mr. Wonderful to say, stop doing that. You know, you're wasting yourself and your loved one's money, and take this thing behind the barn and shoot it and stop. So sometimes you need that person.
Well, you know, the entrepreneurs who present on the show are all very well rehearsed, and all the decisions seem to be made in about 8 or 9 minutes. That can't be. So what goes on behind the scenes? How long does it actually take to vet each individual business idea?
The shortest pitch has been 18 minutes. The longest pitch has been 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We absolutely don't have any knowledge of who the entrepreneurs are. Because trust me, if I got a piece of paper and half those bozos, I would tell them, don't come down the aisle. And it takes us 3 to 6 months to vet the company afterwards and actually physically close the deal. But, you know, like I said, that's the beauty of the tank.
But this is your money on Shark Tank, right? I mean, there's no doubt about that. And that's why you guys have to be so careful. I mean, if it were the network's money, you'd be passing out millions of dollars left and right.
Yeah, I mean, if it's the network's money, I would have my mother, you know, pitch and I would make sure that she gets $10 million.
Exactly.
It really is our money. And people tend to say, well, why are you so mean to people or so hard on them? But, you know, they don't know the story of, you know, Kevin Harrington first season gave a woman $500,000. And I believe that she paid off all her bills and bought a car or something and sent him more bills. Or Barbara, you know, working with somebody named Cactus Jack and the producer moved to Australia with $150,000. So, you know, you're really looking at deploying your own hard cash and capital to people who are, some are responsible, some are amazing, and some are a little irresponsible, and some don't even know what they don't know.
You know what I like about the show? It instructs people on what it takes to present an idea to real investors. So what are the key elements that make a successful Shark Tank pitch?
The most effective pitches are somebody who can get the idea across in a very short amount of time, somebody who you really feel that the business is scalable and it's worth investing in, and the person that you feel is worth investing in because we invest in people.
All right, so that's good. So you've heard your fair share of good, bad, and spectacular new ideas, right?
Sure, I've heard probably in upwards of maybe 2,500 or 3,000 pitches.
Yeah, so you can probably tell when they're walking in the door or as soon as they start to speak if their ideas are going to fly. What are the biggest mistakes some contestants make?
I think some of the biggest mistakes that contestants make sometimes are being extremely technical and not selling the movement or the story in general of why there's a need for it. I think that many of them can overvalue their company if they have little evidence on why their company is of value. And then I think that speaking hypothetically and assuming that, you know, this is a $50 billion market and if I only get 1%.
Yeah,
and,
I know what you mean.
You know, listen, the saying is you can make up your own opinions, but you cannot make up your own facts. And, you know, going out and, you know, doing pitch competitions such as this where you win actually $200,000 or you get favorable votes from the judges, when you walk into another room with investors and you say those type of things, these are reasons why you get validated as a company that potentially be investment worthy.
I guess a lot of it is to make sure that you're not lying to yourself and you take a hard look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, do I have this concept nailed? Because you have a lot at risk here. You're asking people to risk their money and take mortgages on their homes.
Yeah.
Perhaps you're taking one on your own. Or you're raiding your 401k. And there's a lot online here, and people are counting on you. So, Damon, what is the one piece of advice you can give to somebody who thinks they have a good idea enough to go on the Shark Tank?
Yeah, you know what? My number one recommendation is take an affordable step forward. Affordable. Meaning, you know, like you just said, you know, don't go mortgage a house and do everything. You know, listen, you go to a pitch competition such as this, that's an affordable step. What is it taking out of your day? Just time, but, you know, you have little to risk. But if you go and talk to just your family and friends who are very supportive of you and you say, you know what, everybody thinks it's a great idea. I'm going to mortgage my home. I'm going to spend my kids' college fund. And then you then go out to the real world and they tell you your idea may not be that great.
Yeah.
You may not be able to recover from that big move. It could be fatal to you. So I always say just take affordable next steps.
You know, you wrote that when you had your business, FUBU, you remained open to a lot of ideas from all places. And I wanted to stress this for those who are going into this kind of field to keep their options open and to keep their ears open to new ideas. As a matter of fact, you wrote that a lower-level employee told you that certain products were being stolen out of the warehouse, and your response first was to ask him if he was tattling on them. But then he said, no, look, if they're stealing this product they really wanted, maybe you should make more of it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, it was that stage in the company when they were telling me that people were stealing out of the showroom, and what we did realize was the styles that the kids were stealing that worked in the company were the styles that they desperately wanted. And
yeah,
we would go out and make those styles. So, you know, we learned to take and value everybody in the company and everybody's opinion. And I'm not saying that, you know, they got rewarded for stealing.
No.
Obviously,
no.
We had to let them go.
It's the idea behind it, of course. My guest is Damon John. You know him from Shark Tank, and I'd say he is definitely the coolest guy in the room. Well, Damon, thanks for taking the time to spend with us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Hey, folks, I want to talk to you about something real quick. I'm putting on a live event and I'm titling it Protecting Your Family and Your Wealth Through These Uncertain Times. Whether you're getting ready to retire or already in retirement, I've got some info to help you live your best retirement life. So here are some of the topics I'll be covering. The five gremlins that could ruin your best laid plans. And how do you keep your sanity in this news crazy world? Also, what are the best healthcare options for you and your aging parents? Or how do you navigate the loss of a partner and a divorce? And as always, my approach to retiring successfully. And plus, once again, I'll give my fearless forecast for the rest of the year, like the prospect of rising interest rates and what it means to us. And how about those tariffs? How will they affect our lives? And you know, many pundits are talking about an impending recession and an accompanying market downturn. Is that really in the cards for 2018? You'll also have a chance to ask me any question that's on your mind, because as always, my mission is to educate and empower you to help you make the right choices in your life. So join me Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. Once again, that's Thursday, September 13th at the Renaissance Boca Raton Hotel at 10 a.m. For reservations, sign up at our website. You know it. It's stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.